I'm Alan Little, and this is the second part of Turkey, the New Ottomans, a series for the BBC World Service looking at how Turkey is redefining its place in the world. Cairo, 2011. The early days of what we still called then the Arab Spring were days of giddying optimism. The city streets were so thronged that one man had to spend 17 consecutive nights sleeping in his office. He was Turkey's ambassador to Egypt, Hüseyin Botsali.
Give me some sense of what it was like to be here in this building, because we've got the Interior Ministry just over there, the Prime Minister's office up the street. You were right in the thick of it here, weren't you?
And the Parliament next door also. We never felt threatened, whether it's the military checkpoints or it's the neighbourhood committees. They were actually extremely polite and respectful and kissed our flag. We had our share of tear gas because this is an old building and our windows and doors are not well insulated. But it was never aimed at us. And we have a huge flag. We just hang it from the roof. And then I said, this is your national patrimony.
But why were you, as the Turkish ambassador, so welcomed?
They see Turkey as an equal power which has made more progress in a shorter span of time. When they visit Turkey, when they see streets clean, the roads repaired, the urban architecture improving, they come back and they see if the Turks can do it, why should we not be able to do it for ourselves?
Why was Turkey's man in Egypt so celebrated? These were the lands of the old Ottoman Empire. Turkish imperial power had subjugated the Arab nations for centuries. But Turkey alone, it seemed, had found a way to accommodate conservative Islamic values in a modern democratic nation. The Turkish state was an achievement that Muslims could be proud of. The fall of the old Arab dictatorships put Turkey in a new and commanding position.
The new Turkish leadership looks at this almost as Turkey's manifest destiny.
Sinan Ulgen, chairman of Istanbul's Center for Economics and Foreign Policy Studies.
To engage with this region economically, to help this region also to resolve its political conflicts, to be almost an order setter, that is the word that the Turkish Foreign Minister Davutoğlu has used to describe Turkey's potential in the region.
Turkey's Islamists had made the journey from prison cell to government. They'd been elected to power in 2002. Despite the anti-government protests that swept the country this summer, Turkey's Islamists had long since made a vital historic compromise with the modern world. They accepted the secular nature of Turkey's constitution and chose to work within it to seek power through the ballot box. In this programme, I'll test the idea that Turkey's experience can offer the Arab world a way forward, a model. And I'll look at the rise of Turkey as a regional force, as its controversial and charismatic Islamist Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, flexes his foreign policy muscle, seeking to draw the lands of the old Ottoman Empire together under Turkish leadership. On the outskirts of the choking chaos of Cairo's urban sprawl, there's a little island of calm modernity. Since 2007, a Turkish company called Polaris has been developing a vast, high-spec business park. It's well-equipped and services a mix of Egyptian and foreign-owned factories. For Turkey's new power in the region is first and foremost economic. Osman Arikan, the park's general manager, says Turkey sees Egypt in the long term as a vast, unrealized enterprise waiting to be unlocked.
There's a population of 85 million, so there's a big domestic market. Egypt has free and preferential trade agreements with more than 70 countries in the region. When you speak about Egypt, when you have the world map in front of you, Egypt is in the middle. Turkey has this idea of becoming a regional power. You cannot become a regional power just by politics. You have to have an important economy.
Turkey's Islamist government has doubled the size of the Turkish economy in a decade. It has brought unprecedented wealth to a new generation of young, affluent Turks. Could something similar happen under Turkish leadership to Egypt? Can Egyptians emulate the enterprise culture that is transforming Turkey?
Main issue in the factories in Egypt, you have a very high turnover rate. For example, the turnover rate in Turkey in a factory is around 3%. In here, you can reach 15 or 20%. People, they just don't show up in the morning because they are working in the factory. Then it is the harvesting season. They have to go to their farm. They don't come without saying anything. But the workers had a right also. most of them has not been treated in humane conditions for such a long time. So there was not a loyalty between the employer and the employee in that sense. So when you go to some factories, the people do not even have a table or a chair to eat their food.
Turkey's powerful new economy has changed its role in the world. It gives Turkey the muscle to assert itself diplomatically and politically in a region it seeks increasingly to lead. Take Israel. For decades, Turkey sought to prove itself as a dependable ally of the West. It was, for example, one of the first countries to recognize the Israeli state. Turkey's old military-backed governments made Israel a security partner, alienating Turkey's Muslim neighbors. But under Erdogan, that too has changed. He has been ready to defy Israel, even at the cost of damaging his image in the West. After the Israeli bombardment of Gaza in 2008, Erdogan stormed out of a meeting with the Israeli president Shimon Peres at Davos. Yitzhak Levinon, a former Israeli ambassador to Egypt, was there.
I was with the Shimon Peres. Look, Erdogan has his own agenda. And he understands very well that if he would like to reach his first part of the agenda, which is to become the main leader of the Middle East, he will have to pay with Israeli currency. Between Egypt and Turkey, there is a kind of a political affinity to Sunni Muslim countries. Secondly, that both of them, separately, they would like to continue to play a role in the Middle East. While the only difference is that Turkey believes the opportunity now to stand as the main country in that region, while Egypt believes, I'm not going to leave that role, I'm here. Always Turkey had aspiration. Something connected, you know, with the Ottoman Empire.
Erdogan's willingness to confront Israel may have alarmed his allies in the West, but in the Arab world his esteem soared. It reflects perfectly the changing foreign policy priorities of Erdogan's Turkey, a shift away from the traditional emphasis on its Western identity towards re-engaging with the lands of the old Ottoman Empire, Turkey's own geographical and historical backyard. For almost a century, Turkey's ruling elite turned its back on the Ottoman legacy, despising the old multi-ethnic empire of the sultans as backward, corrupt, and unenlightened. This view of history suited their modernizing, westernizing purposes. But under Erdogan, Turkey is re-excavating its imperial Ottoman past. History, a different history, is being put to a new political purpose. There is a greater emphasis on the past Turkey shares, not with Europe, but with its Arab neighbours, and Egypt in particular.
It was conquered in 1517. I mean, the first Ottoman thrust is towards the west, that is, towards the Balkans.
Edem Eldem is professor of late Ottoman history at Istanbul's Boğaziçi University.
By the beginning of the 16th century, there was a big move towards the east or towards the south. One direction is Iran. And the other move is towards the riches of the Red Sea and its trade with the Indian Ocean, and of course, Egypt. Egypt, which until then was still retaining, at least nominally, the caliphate.
How important was Egypt in the Ottoman Empire?
Extremely important. It is crucial in terms of what the British will discover in the 18th and 19th century, the control of the passageway to the Indian Ocean. It is an Islamic population with a deeply anchored presence. It is one of the jewels of the crown.
When Egypt was invaded by Napoleon at the end of the 18th century, Istanbul was completely unprepared for the loss. The court of the Sultan only learned of the disaster from a British sea captain.
It is a very traumatic episode from an Ottoman perspective. First of all, because it takes them, I think, almost a month to learn about it. The Sultan's reaction, Selim III at the time, is, okay, let's wait and see. There's no way for the Ottoman Empire in 1798 to organize an expedition that will successfully claim back Egypt from the French. And therefore, this admission of, you know, let's wait and see, hoping for Nelson to intervene, whatever, it's kind of pathetic in that sense.
That interpretation prevailed. that the loss of Egypt was an early stage in the long, slow decay of an Ottoman Empire that was incapable of innovation or renewal. Throughout the 20th century, Egyptians took it for granted that their own relative poverty could be attributed to the centuries of corrupt and stagnant Ottoman rule, in which religious conservatism had thwarted progress, science and modernity. Khalid Fahmy is chair of history at the American University of Cairo.
What we were taught in school is that Egypt was once, under the Mamluks, a seat of a mighty empire that defied European control, and Egypt was prosperous and wealthy. And then the Ottoman invasion happened, and Egypt and Islam and the Arab world lagged behind developments that were happening in Europe with the scientific revolution, with the Enlightenment, so that by the time Napoleon came in 1798, the gap that separated East from West was so huge as to cause Egypt to be defeated in a very humiliating way. And the cause for this was always the Ottomans.
But Islamists in Egypt, as well as Turkey, are rethinking the Ottoman past. New interpretations are asserting themselves that better suit today's political agenda. The French didn't stay long. The Ottomans took back Egypt and installed a ruler called Muhammad Ali Pasha. Egyptians still consider him the founding father of the modern Egyptian nation-state. But he's one of the great paradoxes of Ottoman history. He lends himself to multiple, often contradictory, interpretations. He's interesting now for the contemporary political purposes to which his life story is put. Under Egypt's old regime, 20th century scholars turned Muhammad Ali Pasha into an Egyptian nationalist, leading the fight for national liberation from Ottoman rule. In fact, he was much more Ottoman than Egyptian. He was from the Balkans, also then part of the Ottoman Empire. His parents were Albanian. His second language, and the language of his court, was Turkish, not Arabic. Egyptian scholars are now arguing that for a century, history has misunderstood him. Khalid Fahmy.
Mehmed Ali, who supposedly wanted to opt out of the Ottoman Empire, this is the nationalist narrative, but when you see the architectural evidence of what he had done, it's the opposite. The first building he built in Cairo is what we call a sabil. A sabil is a water fountain to supply free water for passersby. He built a sabil in memory of one of his sons who died tragically, very young, out of the plague. And he chooses a complete Ottoman style, not in outward appearance, but also in masonry, ornamentation, and decoration.
So there's a scholarly fight for the ownership of his legacy. Some now argue that Muhammad Ali Pasha was an Ottoman to the end. Before he died, for example, he employed two architects from the Ottoman province of Bosnia to design the mosque in which he'd be buried. It too is in high Ottoman style. But for all that, he profoundly reshaped Egypt within the Ottoman Empire at a time of rapid economic and scientific change in Europe. And for Islamists, he is not so much an anti-colonial national liberation leader. He is instead proof that the Ottoman Empire was not, as secular nationalists insist, incapable of internal renewal. Edam Eldin.
He is able to invest constantly, take advantage of this new situation, to invest in empowering himself. And this through some kind of a colonial network, that is basically through cotton, the cotton trade, and moving in the direction of the West as some kind of a channel of a new modernity. And by the 1830s, he can rebel against the Ottoman state and even arrive as far as Kutahya, that is, 400 kilometers from Istanbul, with his army.
And part of that is borrowing models from the West. Is he forming a kind of nascent nation-state in Egypt on a European model?
Yes. I mean, retrospectively speaking, yes, because he is importing those elements of modernity that come with the nation-state, schools, an army, military training, industrial investment. It's basically the consolidation of a structure in a region which is culturally more coherent and the Ottoman Empire itself. I mean, it would be too early to call it really a nation state, but it's something that will eventually be used by Egyptian nationalism.
Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the Prime Minister of Turkey, emboldened by economic success into a new engagement with the Arab world, came to Cairo after the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak. He was one of the first foreign leaders to do so, backing the people against the dictatorship. Many of those who'd risen against the old regime were Erdogan's natural allies, supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood that had been banned and whose leaders had been jailed.
Assalamu ala shabab
Misr. Prime Minister Erdogan came to Egypt with a heroic reputation in the Arab world. Hundreds of thousands of Egyptians lined the streets to welcome him, and they cheered him from the airport all the way into the heart of this tumultuous metropolis.
Assalamu ala shabab Misr.
And he came to speak here at Cairo's magnificent modern opera house. He delighted the crowd by denouncing Israel and its treatment of the Palestinians, and the Egyptian crowd loved it.
Shukran. Shukran.
But then he said something that stunned his Arab audience and dismayed them, something which highlighted in the starkest way the difference, the contradiction between what Turkey has achieved over decades and what the new Egypt aspires to become. In a television interview, he told Egyptians that they had nothing to fear from a secular state. His hosts in the Muslim Brotherhood and many of those who'd lined the streets to greet him were appalled.
Secularism has no future in the Arab world. No future for any division between my life as a Muslim and my religion.
Essam Al-Aryan is a doctor and a leading member of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood.
When Erdogan emerges as a leader, I was in jail because of my activities as a Muslim brother. I was in jail for more than 8.5 years.
And what was that like?
Very good experience. I studied history, Sharia, Holy Quran.
It is a measure of how confident Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood then was that they dismissed the Turkish model out of hand. Instead, they set about using an election victory to try to push through a new constitution that would give the leading Muslim clerics a powerful role in the government of the country. It is partly this that led so many non-Islamists onto the streets, partly this that produced last month's bizarre paradox of pro-democracy protesters welcoming a military coup. But it was a stark demonstration of the difference between Turkey's Islamists and Egypt's. Here's Essam Al-Aryan again on Erdogan's defense of secular statehood.
I hear the speech and follow what the dispute. Erdogan himself said that every country has its own model. Secularism is good for Turkey because the long history, clashes and conflict between the Ottoman Empire and the nationalists in Turkey.
Why? Why historically did Turkey's Islamists make peace with secularism within a European-style nation-state when Egypt's remain so suspicious of it? The difference between Turkey and Egypt is reflected in the fates of two men, each of whom in his lifetime was viewed as the father of his nation. Mustafa Kemal Atatürk is still venerated across the political spectrum in Turkey. He was an army officer and a First World War hero, and throughout the 20th century, the army frequently intervened in politics in the name of his legacy, seizing power to defend the secular constitution that Atatürk had created. Gemal Abdel Nasser was also an army officer who seized power in Egypt in 1952.
The Arab nationalism idea is Arab solidarity, Arab unity or Arab union.
Nasser too sought an explicitly secular republic for Egypt, with the army at the heart of political life as its guarantor.
Must be with the approval and the will of the people unanimously.
But in 1967, Nasser waged war on Israel, promising the Arab world something that no Arab leader had achieved since the days of the Crusades, the reconquest of Jerusalem. In just 6 days, Egypt suffered a catastrophic and humiliating defeat.
Less than 15 hours after the fighting began at dawn this morning, there was every evidence that Israel has already won the war, though fighting will continue.
General Sami Saif Al-Yazal is a retired army officer and is now a political consultant. He had just graduated from military college. He remembers the pre-1967 status army officers enjoyed.
People were looking to the army that it is the elite of the elites. If you are an officer and you go to marry a girl, they will give the girl to you because you are an officer. They will not ask about your family, they will not ask about are you well off or not. But if you are an officer, that's great. They will give you their girl.
As war approached, he was assigned as a tank commander in the Sinai Desert.
I was in my tank at a place called Jabal Lubna, and I have been shot by a skyhook. The whole tank was actually jumped just like a toy, and I lost two of my crew, and I have been wounded in my back, over my kidney, two shrapnels.
You were then evacuated, obviously.
No, I walked 2.5 days in the desert, walking in the night, during night time.
So you walked through Israeli-occupied Sinai?
Wounded, bleeding for 2.5 days, yes.
What was going on in your head?
Very down. I can see the Sinai already gone. I've seen many of my colleagues killed. I was trying to help another officer, younger than me. Unfortunately, after passing the Suez Canal, we lost him before getting to the hospital. Afterwards, I start to see the blame on the eyes of the Egyptians. And I've seen this in the streets, in the eyes of the people, and even my family and my friends. They give you those kind of eyes, full of blame and full of pain.
And do you think the Egyptians felt humiliated?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, the France of the Arab world in particular.
For many Egyptian secularists, this was the defining moment, the moment that separated their fate from that of Turkey. Khalid Fahmy.
At the core of Turkish secularism is actually the military. Islam might have been cast out of the picture, but the army is in. And this was because of Atatürk. Atatürk, as a military commander, the state that we called Turkey is a result of this. Now, if you think about Nasser in Egypt, Nasser is a defeated president. The 67 defeat is not a small defeat. This is why one cannot fathom to call Cairo airport Nasser airport, unlike the airport in Istanbul, Atatürk airport. There's not a single statue of Nasser in Cairo. Our secular project was defeated in 67.
As the public esteem in which the army was held fell after 1967, Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood worked to build public trust among the pious and the poor. Over decades, their leaders were jailed by an unelected secular government, backed by an army whose reputation had been so damaged by the disastrous Six-Day War. This is Essam Al-Aryan on how the Muslim Brotherhood won so much popular support. He was speaking to me before last month's military takeover.
We are near to the people. I am working in my charity hospital till now. And also, I go to the hospital by the common transport, not by my own car. So the people believe that we are the real representatives for them, suffering their suffer, struggling their struggle.
There is another key difference. Before Erdogan was prime minister, he was mayor of Istanbul. Turkey's Islamists did not go from prison cell to presidency overnight. By the time they were elected, they already had experience of governing. They had moved beyond the politics of identity to the politics of real problem solving. Khalid Fahmy, chair of history at the American University of Cairo.
When I first went to Istanbul, I spent a whole summer, and there was water cuts every day for 3 hours. Traffic was horrendous. It was everything that I could easily recognize from Cairo. Now, Istanbul is a beautiful, functional, charming city. This is a result of many things, but it's also the result of Erdogan personally, when he was mayor of Istanbul and got his hands literally dirty in dealing with garbage. And there was a huge garbage collection problem in Istanbul. Running a city as big as Istanbul in the 80s and 90s, the Islamists of Turkey have acquired an enormous experience on the municipal level. And this is something Egyptian Islamists never had. I think you become a good Islamist if you know how to collect garbage.
It is their failure to govern, to address the economic needs of the people, that more than anything brought the masses back onto the street last month and led to the toppling of Egypt's young, democratically elected Islamist government. And there is yet another key difference. Turkey is a European power as well as an Asian one. It shares a history through its Ottoman past with the nation-states of Europe, and Egypt does not.
There has always been a nostalgia in Turkey and in the Arab world for the Ottoman Empire coming from Islamists. You know, a time when Muslims could travel freely without passports, without borders. But I think there are many other differences between the story of Islamism in Egypt as opposed to Turkey. One of them is the way Turkey can expand, so to speak, and its horizons includes Europe. Europe is not part of Egyptian horizons. Our hinterland, our horizons are actually Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. And of course, they're very, very different.
What happened to the idea at the heart of the Arab Spring, loaded with urgent hope and earnest expectation 2 years ago? The idea that made Turkey's ambassador to Egypt a hero on the Cairo street? The idea that Turkey could serve as a model for Egypt? It did not survive first contact with the democratic process. In Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood's refusal to make Turkey's historic compromise with secularism brought the masses back onto the streets and the army back into power. Next week, Turkey in Europe. What has Prime Minister Erdogan's new Ottomanism done to Turkey's decades-old yearning for a fully European destiny? Turkey, the New Ottomans is presented by me, Alan Little, and produced for the BBC World Service by Jane Beresford.